Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The countdown is on until Election Day. We have the latest fundraising haul in the state Supreme Court race and break down what you need to know ahead of April 4th. Plus, lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee grill state agency officials as they kick off the budget writing process. And the newly appointed Secretary of State says she wants to have more responsibilities in our elections, but says a special election for her seat is not necessary. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 31st.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to our election preview,
yes.
Right? I mean, we're going to get into the weeds of a lot of the key races. But let's first start with the state Supreme Court race. Before we get into kind of the outcomes and how the candidates have to perform, what that will look like, let's just talk about your reporting, J.R., and following the money. Mm-hmm. People who have been watching the show have known that you have been keeping a track of this. And the price tag, as of today, is roughly $45 million mm-hmm. spent between both campaigns. For Janet Protasiewicz, about $24 million. Dan Kelly at $19 million. And we do know these numbers are going to be even higher mm-hmm. because not all of the organizations are reporting how they're spending this race. And we know that number is going to be much, much higher come Tuesday.
So we have a couple things I'm following. One, both campaigns are filing their campaign finance reports. We got new numbers from Protasiewicz and Kelly this week. So, you know, there is a piece there. Protasiewicz has spent $11 million by herself just since from January 1st through March 20th. Kelly, about $2 million. Add in then independent expenditure reports. So if you do an ad that's express advocacy, vote for, vote against, support, oppose, it's a file report with the Ethics Commission. So I go through those every day. Then I've got sources who show me, you know, what they're seeing TV buys. You know, plus I've got like some public pronouncements of we're going to spend X million dollars. So I kind of add that to my sheet. What I don't have, though, are issue advocacy on digital ads. They're very difficult to track. What I'm talking about is if you go on YouTube or on Facebook and you see an ad, either it's a still ad or a video that rolls and says, Emily Fannin's a great gal, call her up until she's a great gal, right? That's an issue ad. It's not express advocacy. That's not reported anywhere. Even campaigns have a hard time tracking that. But I've had an estimate of 5 to 15 million more, possibly, of those. Now, they're just pulling numbers out, just guesstimating. Mm-hmm. But let's safely say we're talking a $50 million plus race as we sit here right now versus Supreme Court. The question is why? Well, yes, there's a lot at stake on Tuesday in terms of the maps in Wisconsin, the abortion ban, issues like that. It's not just about Wisconsin. It's about 2024 and who wins the presidency. That's why so much national money is coming in, because they see Wisconsin as really one of 4 to 5 swing states left. Every cycle they talk about a dozen or so. We're down now to Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, us. And then you can kind of maybe like make an argument for a Pennsylvania or maybe a North Carolina, you know, see how things shake out. But we are a linchpin of what's going to happen in 2024. Remember, I've covered 6 presidential elections in Wisconsin. All but only 2 have been decided by more than 22,000 votes. They had Barack Obama on the ballot. The other 4, 22, less than 22,000, less than 21,000, less than 12,000, less than 6,000. We had a lawsuit filed in 2020 with the Supreme Court, 4-3 decision. I'm getting at what's driving this spending. And oh, by the way, all these groups are going, hey, there's nothing else really happening nationally in 2023. I can go try out a new get out the vote effort, a new way to communicate to voters and see how does it work.
True.
There's one group that's just doing $140,000 in digital ads to see if it motivates people to vote. That's all they're now. They're a group that leans Democratic, but they're just trying stuff out. It's all adding up to this expensive race. And so the question is, what's going to determine things on Tuesday?
Right. And of course, we've mentioned plenty of times of what is at stake here. But think about, you know, if Protasiewicz were to win, let's talk about scenarios now. there is very, very likely that Democrats right now and their allies are already drafting lawsuits to challenge Republican victories, to undo their victories when it comes to Act 10, voter ID laws, the electoral maps like you mentioned, executive powers. And then on the flip side, if we see a Dan Kelly victory, it would almost simply be the status quo, right? The court would still be controlled by conservatives, 4-3. Now, if Protasiewicz win, it would be the first time in 15 years that the court flips to liberals, which was the last time in 2008. So a lot of play here, but it always comes down to how the candidates perform in key demographics of Wisconsin. We know it's the Wow counties, the Bow counties, but I think both of us are going to be watching Dane County specifically, because if you compare it to the February primary, I mean, I feel like every election and it is just more and more saturated, you know, leaning Democrats too. So there's a chance there that Protasiewicz can almost just do outstanding there and even better, and doesn't maybe need to pick up other counties.
So watch Waukesha County on Tuesday. How does Dan Kelly do compared to Tim Michaels, Ron Johnson, and Brian Hagedorn? So Tim Michaels lost by 3.4 percentage points. He didn't get to 60% in Waukesha County. Ron Johnson won by basically a percentage point. He got to 63%. Brian Hagedorn in 2019 got to 69%, I think. Now, that seems like eons ago in politics to get that number for a Republican, but really Ron Johnson's my number. You got to get to about 63-64 to have a shot, unless Dane County goes crazy. If Protasiewicz comes out Dane County with 80% plus of the vote, that's really hard to overcome. And it's not just about the percent, it's the turnout. What's going on the campus, UW-Madison? What's going on in Milwaukee, in Waukesha? And who's voting? It's not just raw numbers. We're looking at absentee ballot numbers coming in like every day from the clerks. The Elections Commission show us, okay, we have had 450,000 requests for absentee ballots already, all right? Early voting goes through, I think, Saturday with some of the bigger communities in Wisconsin. That number's going to grow. And I've had people try to say, well, okay, Waukesha's got a good number of absentee ballot requests. Like, that's true. But are those Republicans voting? Are they Democrats voting? That's the challenge. We don't have partisan registration in Wisconsin. So I can go, okay, voter X casts a ballot. I can guess voter X is probably Democrat. What they do is they go, all right, I'm looking at Dane County. I know Madison is this liberal. I know that mail-in votes tend to be more liberal than that, so I can kind of project out what's going on. It looks good in Dane County for the liberal right now. But again, we don't know for sure who's turning out to cast these ballots. What I am seeing, though, is if we have 450,000 absentee ballot requests already, turnout 1.5 million, like, is that's probably realistic on Tuesday? And the question becomes, again, who turns out on Tuesday? Who's motivated to vote? Trump just got indicted. Does that all of a sudden create a groundswell of support for among conservatives? We're going to go turn out and show those guys what's going on. I don't know. It's the wild card. It's the part where we're so deep in the weeds. We've seen so many numbers. The campaigns are so, like, looked at so many polls are going, we don't know anymore. Like, we feel like this is where we're at. But this could happen, that could happen. It's hard to figure out what's going to happen in the next few days.
And learning from the midterms, too, what we're seeing the state Republican Party and individuals like Ron Johnson try to convince their members to go vote early more. I talked to the state GOP chair, Brian Schimming, about this. And, like, are you encouraging more people? You know, you said you wanted to do that. Because their argument is that typically every election they go into, they're 3, 4, 6,000, 10,000 ballots behind of all those other people, because typically more Democrats are more appealed to voting early. So that's something, too, that they've been trying to ramp up, and will be interesting to see if there's more interest there.
And what we're seeing on the conservative side is a base play. Everything you see from them right now is about trying to tear down Protasiewicz, and their communication to build up the base, like get them angry, get them engaged. This campaign has been really odd in that I can't recall a pure 30-second ad that is pro-Dan Kelly the course of the campaign. Now, Protasiewicz, let's not kid ourselves, most of her ads are negative. But I do see ads, you know, she's a judge, a prosecutor, common sense person, you know, the uplifting music. There are some that are half Protasiewicz negative, half Kelly positive. But I don't see a full 30-second ad of, like, pro-Dan Kelly. It makes me wonder why. It suggests to people I talk to, he is behind. They're trying to find a way to discourage the Protasiewicz voters to turn out and to get his base motivated by being angry about who this person is. And let's look. She has a lot of challenging decisions on the circuit court with her decision, like
yes,
sentencing.
No doubt. Mm-hmm.
Plenty of fodder there. Mm-hmm. And I had two Democrats who tell me, if Jennifer Doerr had gotten through, we'd be in a lot of trouble. They feel better about facing Kelly because they feel like the polling they see shows he's not that likable, right? That he's got his own problems, and that helps a little bit in where they feel like they're at right now in this race.
All right, let's move on to the 8th Senate District. We've talked about this before. What is up for grabs is a Republican supermajority in the Senate. Now, it was last week that Dan Canoldo, the Republican candidate who is facing Democrat Jody Habish-Sinkin, he said last week that he talked about this, about the GOP supermajority, and that he would, quote, certainly consider supporting launching impeachment proceedings against Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate Janet Protasiewicz. He said she has, quote, failed. Now, why is this important? I mean, well, this is what the race has really been all shaped about. We know it's a very red district. But him saying this, too, I mean, was it to energize people to vote for him? But we know it's just so rare that the Senate has even had these powers to begin with. It's been over 160 years since it's ever been used, and it failed. Plus, you need all Republicans on board in order to impeach someone. And the rules and the statutes are a little confusing. Does this mean the governor? Does this mean judges? There's a lot at play here. Now, looking at the Democrat in the race, too, she called this enormous consequences. So it seems that Habish-Sinkin is talking about this on the campaign trail. But it will be a true test. I mean, will Janet Protasiewicz, you know, help her, carry her in this race in a really, really red district? It kind of remains up in the air. And money's also played a big factor, too.
55% Republican district, normal turnout, normal election.
Yeah.
She has outraised him in the course of the race. But this has been overshadowed dramatically by the Supreme Court race. You're not seeing a lot of people talking about this race because there are some Democrats who feel like, if we got Janelle Branchen through the primary, that would have been a better scenario for us to try and pick this off. Knodel is well known. He's been in office since 2009, I believe. He has told me that his assembly has changed over the, because he's had a map that was created in 2001, 2011, and 2021. So we've had his map changed. 22. His map's changed. So in the course of those three maps, he's like half the Senate district, something like two-thirds of it. So they know him. He's been around for a long time. He's been in office. So there's a sense that this race may need, for Democrats, may need a strong Protasiewicz performance to help her get across the finish line. Now, could she win without that? Possibly. But in a normal turnout, normal situation, this should not be a competitive seat. Well, by the way, even if Canoldo wins, it could be a temporary victory. If Protasiewicz wins, then there's that lawsuit we expect that would be filed to challenge the lines. You could have a new map by next fall. It's a lot of ifs,
right?
Ifs. Oh, by the way, on impeachment, there's a legislative council memo that lays out all the ways to remove somebody from office. It notes who's subjected to the impeachment process is not spelled out in state law. So even if you try to impeach somebody, you may have to go through a lawsuit to find who, if they're eligible to be impeached.
Yeah.
And it says for corruption or for a crime. So I don't know. I mean, I guess you can try and make a case for corruption if it's defined in state law. But there are lots of legal hurdles you would see for anybody to impeach, even if they win on Tuesday.
All right, let's move on to the other political news of the week. We're first going to start with a committee hearing that was about a bipartisan bill to expand Medicaid benefits for new moms. Now, this is a bill that has mustered a lot of Republican support just in recent months, as there's been more of a nationwide shift from Republicans for support of this that would expand coverage up to a full year. And it comes in many states that have outlawed or completely limited abortion access since the overturn of Roe v. Wade. So the discussion here is that, I mean, really, this bill has been introduced in the past. Mm-hmm. It never really got out of committee. I believe the last time it was introduced in 2021. But we're seeing the shift now of Republicans trying to hop on and tout these type of bills as part of their pro-life agenda. So it does stand a chance. Governor Tony Evers is almost certainly to sign it if it reaches his desk because he has the same provision in his state budget. Now, we know joint finance is very likely. going to remove all those mm-hmm. policy provisions out of there. They've even said they're going to do that. So it stands a much better chance going through the legislature. Before we get into more about the future of this bill, let's highlight the DHS. She's a chief operating officer there. She spoke specifically of how this would be, you know, life-changing, this would happen, because some statistics that she shared is that about 50% of the pregnancy-related deaths that she looks at, about two-thirds of those are Medicaid patients. And she believes there's been, about 90% of all of those could have been preventable. So let's just hear a little bit from her about her reviewing these cases and just what she thinks it could mean for the state.
From the statistics and from the cases that we're reviewing, we're seeing this real time, year after year after year, case after case. One of the key recommendations that comes out that could have prevented deaths is the importance of expanding postpartum Medicaid coverage to at least a year. It's something that could have saved lives, and we know that it could potentially save future lives. And when I think about my daughters, my two daughters, I really contemplate, is Wisconsin the place that I want them as young Black women to grow up and have their own children? But we have a historic opportunity to change that all around.
Now, the one question right now is, where do GOP leaders stand? Reached out for both of those offices, haven't heard back from them on this bill. Typically, Robin Voss hasn't been supportive of this measure in the past, but that remains to be seen with a lot of their members. I believe I counted 63 lawmakers are signed on to this bill.
So there's been resistance in the past this because you don't get this in the private sector. And one of the philosophies have been among Republicans is, why should we make a benefit more substantial on a government program that you can't get in the private sector? This, though, as you mentioned, the shifting attitude because of what's going on, the abortion laws in this country, that could maybe create an avenue for it to get done finally.
And we also officially launched off budget hearings this week. And it always starts with agency heads sitting down, talking to the lawmakers on the committee. But it kind of turned into a little bit of a grill session, mm-hmm. you can say. First up was the Department of Corrections on Tuesday. Kevin Carr was grilled about why the 125-year-old Green Bay Correctional Prison is still open, which has been really crumbling mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, it's 125 years old. Lawmakers also on Joint Finance raised questions about the ongoing licensing backlog at the Department of Safety and Professional Services. We also heard from DOA on Thursday as well. First, let's just hear from a little bit of an exchange from one of the co-chairs, Representative Mark Bourne, questioning Secretary Carr about what is going on at this prison. Why is this still open? Let's take a listen.
Some of your testimony included trying to get folks, especially non-violent folks, out of your facilities, finding ways to do that, to lower your population, which you said would help with staffing. I think that's fair. But I think it's also fair to say that using tools in these types of professional reports to consider changes to very old infrastructure that is harder to run in a safe way could also provide some staffing relief. Why are you not looking at the possibility of capital investments to also help in a multi-pronged approach to...
It all depends on how you define capital investments. If what the definition of a capital investment is building a new prison, I don't think that there's any appetite by our administration to increase the number of beds that we have currently in our system by building a new facility. I know how long it takes to get something done. That is something that's not going to immediately fix our vacancy problem. That's something that might happen in 3 or 4 years. All of this talk about capital projects aren't going to have the types of impact that I think are required in order for us to meet the moment.
So, J.R., you were in the room watching many of these hearings this week. Anything in particular stand out to you?
So, Green Bay, remember, the governor's budget, capital budget, proposes actually adding a facility at Green Bay to treat inmates with their health issues. There's a question of, why do you want to spend $25 million to do that with this prison that is in not great shape? Carr made an interesting observation of, if you guys want to build a new one, essentially, we need to talk about like criminal justice reform. He wasn't committing to it. He was basically hinting at the fact that we talked before. Governor Evers stated when he ran for governor in 18, he wanted to reduce the prison population in Wisconsin. How do you, if that's your stated goal, increase capacity by building a new prison, right? So Carver's talking about other places that have closed prisons, like Texas. So could you find a way to reach a compromise of closing one, replacing it with a new facility, but then tying some kind of reforms? I don't know it's there like that. We call it soup in politics, right? That's going to be soup just yet. But that might be a path through this. But you're going to see Republicans saying, wait, we can't spend money on Green Bay to improve it or to expand things. We want it torn down. We want it to be gone and a new facility in its place. So that's going to be a huge issue for them about spending money in that place in the budget.
All right, let's move on to an interview that I did this week with the new Secretary of State, Sarah Godlewski. Now, she's only been in the office for a little over 2 weeks now. And, of course, Republicans have been highly critical of not holding a special election after she was appointed by Governor Tony Evers. So I kind of try to pick her brain a little bit. I mean, what do you want to do with an office that doesn't have a lot of duties, only has about one full-time staff member and herself, has a budget of about roughly $260,000. So I asked her that, and she kind of suggested using the office to increase transparency in elections, but then also downplayed having a special election. So it's almost in a sense, JR, she kind of wants it both ways. Let's just roll to the video of me asking her whether she believes it's fair to fill in after there's still about 3.5 years, or 3.5 years plus of Doug LaFollette's term. Let's take a listen. Do you think it's fair to serve in a role that still has 3.5+ years left in an elected office when you were not elected to it?
I mean, this is the exact thing that Wisconsinites get sick of, is the partisan politics. The governor has the ability that's outlined in the Constitution to appoint a constitutional officer if the office is vacated. And the reason Governor Evers, when we had a conversation, chose this kind of route was because he wanted someone who could start on day one. In addition, I think Wisconsinites don't even want another election. We have a pretty competitive election here on April 4th, and to think that we're going to go through this again, which is again going to cost the taxpayers millions of dollars, they just want their elected officials to come to Madison and to serve, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux said in a statement that, you know, this is another example of her using an office on campaigning on issues, and she has no relationship to her office. He just simply said, we should be holding a special election. So this has been the Republican argument for a while. Mm-hmm. It was last week they passed a resolution on the floor that will not force the governor to call one, but it was more of a political statement saying, hey, we believe this should happen after a very, very close race with Doug LaFollette and his Republican challenger, then Amy Loudenbeck. So when I kind of asked her, too, I'm like, well, what do you mean by these election duties, election integrity? She said she doesn't necessarily want to, you know, overhaul, which Republicans floated during the midterms of WEC, the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She instead just wants to go travel around the state, talk to clerks, maybe find ways to get people to the polls, kind of just throwing things out there. Still depends on what actually comes out of this. Also asked her about her political future, because that has also been another Republican criticism, is that she only took this office to further her political career. Some Republicans were also suggesting that there was some collusion going on between Doug LaFollette, Godlewski, and Evers, that this was all planned, that we knew shortly after Doug LaFollette was going to be inaugurated that he was going to leave. But she said to me that she has no plans to run for higher office right now. So, because I asked her about governor and U.S. Senate race, and then I followed up and I said, well, would you pledge to not run for higher office after you get out of this position? And she declined to offer or answer that question a few times. So it kind of remains to be seen what she does with this office, what her political future will look like.
Yeah, like I said last week, she is in the conversation for 2020 for governor
right
away because of this. You know, the Senate race wouldn't be till 2028. I don't know if she wants to seek re-election as Secretary of State, but she is in the mix for 2026 for something.
All right, let's move to stock picks this week. And rising is the now kind of pretty expensive Green Bay mayoral race.
So I did not have a $1 million campaign for Green Bay mayor on my bingo card when this year started. So looking at independent expenditure reports, I've seen north of $600,000 spent by independent groups on the race in Green Bay for mayor. that was kind of interesting. Started poking around the finance reports for the candidates. You add it all up, and I haven't seen the spending from the candidates yet, but it's going to get north of $1 million probably. What's fascinating to me is this is basically a mini version of the Supreme Court race. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin pumped money into Genrich's campaign at the end of 2022 and early this year to boost how much money he had. He is able to go on TV, and the candidate rate is better than group rate, right? He's getting more bang for his buck on the airways than the outside groups are. It's interesting that that's going on, you know, that methodology. Now, the question is, why is the mayor of the third largest city so important? It is not about who's in that office necessarily, like for who's fixing the roads. It's about 2024. Remember, the mayor of Green Bay will have a say in how many early voting sites there are in Green Bay next year, how long early voting goes on next year, because, you know, he deals with the clerk and that kind of stuff. That's all about the presidential race. You wouldn't see this kind of spending normally, but Green Bay is a key piece of the puzzle again in 2024. That's why so much money is coming in for what's usually a sleepy mayoral race, right? Mm-hmm. Also, you have Eric Genrich, who has irritated Republicans with some of his decisions while he's been in office, that has had extra motivation to try and beat him, especially on election stuff. Remember all the theories about the Green Bay elections, who had access to absentee ballots in 2020, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a little bit of extra spice this one for Republicans.
And Mix this week is Republican funding by the state party.
So we talked about the $56 grand raise in the first period. It's gotten a lot better, north of $1 million, but still blown out of the water by what the Democrats did in the six-week window. So we have fundraising from February, by the 7th through March 20th, that six-week window. And the state Democratic Party outraised the Republicans 5-1. So you've seen more money come in for the Republican Party, but it fails in comparison to what the Democrats are doing. And the big question is, why has the conservative side spent money so inefficiently in a Supreme Court race? We talked about this. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin has pumped more than $8 million into Prosewich's campaign. Now, $8 million of that is just straight cash transfers. That she has then plowed into TV with that better rate for candidates, which is why she is right now spending less on TV than they are, the conservative coalition, but has more points, more ads on the air. On the Republican side, you don't have the big donors going through the state party the way the Democrats are. J.B. Pritzker gave $1 million, the state Democratic Party. George Soros gave $1 million, the state Democratic Party. They realize what's at stake in 24 and going there. The conservative side is not doing that. Why? Why are they going to Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce? Why is that the way to go with their money? It seems like the national conservative folks have woken up late to this race. I'm just now seeing this past week, like the Wall Street Journal doing opinion pieces about the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin,
right,
and
yeah.
Fox News National doing stuff about...
They're a lot more invested, Fox News specifically. I've seen a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Where were they 6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
4 weeks ago, we were seeing the stuff on the liberal side. The party has just not been the best vehicle, and it is going to have, now if, I'm not predicting who's going to win on Tuesday, but if Kelly loses, one of the postmortems will be, this was the most inefficient use of campaign dollars that people have seen in a race in Wisconsin, I don't want to say ever, but a long time, while the liberals have had the most efficient use of money. Because remember, the big dollar donations go to the state party, can transfer to Protosewich. The groups then are doing digital ads and get out the vote. Digital ads are same rate, candidates versus groups. I am seeing all kinds of groups who don't only play in Wisconsin doing GOTV, in part because they're doing a tryout for 2024. Yeah. This is a great way to kind of like, oh, you know.
Why not?
We want to try and reach the voters a different way. How is it going to work? So the party, the GOP, may have some, you know, another reckoning to do after this is over. Again, we'll see what happens.
If.
But it's fascinating to watch that Dick Uihlein is running checks to Fair Courts America, but won't write them to state GOP.
Right. All right. And falling this week, we just got about a minute left, is Milwaukee Transit System, because there was another report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan group that gets into these reports for us. And it's about the Milwaukee fiscal cliff that we've been talking about for a long, long time, because once those COVID money dries up in 2025, they're going to be facing a lot of challenges.
I don't know if any government in Milwaukee right now is in good shape.
Yeah,
I don't want to be, you know, flip about it, but This is a piece of the Milwaukee County puzzle. Here's your Milwaukee County Transit System, fiscal cliff 2025. It's like the same thing
same
for
record.
The city, mm-hmm. the county, and now then, it, you know, granted, pension issues over here, other stuff over here, but it is another reason for the challenge they face and Republicans going, okay, how much do we want to help Milwaukee in this budget? Asked this week, the co-chairs of finance at a little pre-meeting before the first day of public hearings, hey, any more talk about the shared revenue stuff? It's going to be in the budget or out. Still be, to be determined. So that's still in the works, how they're going to do things and what they might do for Milwaukee.
Right. In the budget or separate bill, too. Still a chance. All right. That will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.